explore the little things that can inspire us all. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib. Listen to Small Joys, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Recently released 911 calls capture the panic of bystanders in the moments after the Champlain Towers South condo partially collapsed on June 24th in Surfside, Florida.
What's going on? Tell me exactly what happened.
I don't know. There's a lot of smoke going on. I can't see anything right now.
You see smoke?
Oh, my God.
Ma'am, the operator
died. Oh, my God.
Is anyone injured?
Apart from the tragedies of many lives lost, the disaster has brought new nationwide scrutiny of condo associations, how they operate and how they manage finances and building maintenance. Sarah Blasky is an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald, where she leads the team reporting on the building collapse, the condo's history, and condo association. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
What are the expectations of the final death toll at this point? Do we know?
We heard from the county last night that the final death toll is thought to be 98. Of those 98 individuals, all but a couple have been identified by authorities and their family members have been informed. For the few that have not yet been identified, those efforts are ongoing.
So I guess the rest of the story is the cleanup and what happens to the property, but really the long-term story is how did this happen? Was it allowed to happen ultimately? How are investigators working on a forensic explanation for the collapse?
So federal investigators have come to the collapse site, and what they will do is they will look at all of the debris. They will go over the building plans. They will go over any details from previous renovations to the building. They'll go over anything that they can find. They'll interview witnesses, people that were in the building. And through that process, they will try to understand what happened. And I think it's important for especially listeners who are outside of Miami, who have not necessarily been as involved in this process, to understand a couple of things. One is that we still don't know what happened. Mm-hmm. We don't know what triggered an initial failure of any part of the building. But even more than that, we don't know why the building failed in such a catastrophic way. And so that's really, those are the two things that investigators will be focusing on. One, what failed first and why, and then two, what were the reasons that, you know, if one thing failed in the building, why did, you know, half that building come down? And that's really what everyone wants to know, because until we know that, it's hard to change laws or do anything that would prevent a tragedy like this from happening again. First, we have to understand why it happened.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're kind of looking a little bit behind the scenes and what role the condo association might have had in everything that has happened at the building collapse in Surfside, Florida. My guest is Sarah Blasky. She's an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald. She leads the team reporting on the collapse and the condo's history and condo association. Coming up later in the program, we're going to be talking to a consumer rights attorney. We're talking to somebody from Ohio and who understands the Ohio Condo Association laws. If you have a question or comment for them later on, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sarah, a number of lawsuits have been filed relating to the collapse, and I'm wondering if there's a way to summarize. Are those preemptory, since we don't know why and how this happened? What are they shooting for?
Well, I think the easiest way to think about it is they're shooting for damages. There is a class action lawsuit. There are also individual lawsuits. It's still kind of playing out in court how you know, who's going to continue forward as an individual, who might join that class action. Most of the original lawsuits were filed by survivors. And then as we got more names of victims, the families of those that died in the collapse have also filed lawsuits. What they're looking for are damages. And you know, one of the interesting things here and just worth mentioning is the condo association, the condo itself had insurance policies but that probably will not cover the amount. The insurance companies have already pledged to pay the full amount of the policies. So there, you know, in terms of who else will have to pay, that still remains unclear, but it's, you know, will it be from a building sale? Will it be from, you know, X, Y, or Z other thing? But that's really what's going on. But no one seems to say that they shouldn't pay. The insurance companies are not trying to say that this is a situation where they shouldn't pay in this case.
There's been a lot of revelations regarding memos, correspondence among the members of the condo association. Can you summarize that for us, what we know now about what was going on regarding a 2018 engineering report?
Sure. So Just so everyone's on the same page here, a condo is an apartment building where every unit has an individual owner, and then the collective of all of those owners own the building together. They all own a portion of the building, and so they have a governing body, the condo board, that makes decisions for the building as a whole. They collect money when they need to do repairs, et cetera. And what the condo board in 2018 at Champlain Towers South realized was that they needed to start making some serious repairs. They hired an engineer named Frank Morabito to come out and do an overall analysis of the safety and security of their structure. What Mr. Morabito found in 2018 was deterioration of structural elements of the building. So what does that mean? Basically, the concrete that makes up the floors of part of the building was starting to deteriorate. The steel reinforcement inside of it, the rebar, was also potentially a reason for this deterioration. It was rusting inside the concrete and breaking the concrete. And what was most interesting about Mr. Morabito's 2018 report is he said that this was going to be a costly repair. He said he wasn't sure what the extent of the damage was because the damage was hidden underneath tiles on the pool deck. And that thirdly, the pool deck had been designed or constructed incorrectly way back in 1980 when this building was built. And that had caused water to pool on the pool deck. Think of it as a patio that's actually part of the overall structure of the building. There had been water pooling on that structural slab for 40 years. And what he said is, it's time to improve the waterproofing. That water has done a lot of damage. This needs to be done quickly. Some people have criticized Mr. Morabito for not acting with more alarm. He actually wrote a lot of this on page, I believe, 7 of 9 in his summary. We would call that burying the lead in our profession.
Right.
But ultimately, the condo association was moving forward. The biggest hangup, though, was the money. So at first, the cost of these repairs was supposed to be about $9 million. And what Mr. Morabito said in his follow-up reports was this number was going to get worse if you let this go any further. The condo board has discussions. These things have to go back and forth. The town has to give permits, et cetera, et cetera. 3 years passed, more or less, and the cost has ballooned to $16 million right before the collapse. And so they actually had not yet begun those repairs on the pool deck, and they still did not know the extent of the damage. And we still do not know because they had not yet taken up those tiles that were covering up that part of the building.
So 1980, the building was constructed, and I'm wondering if this has raised red flags for other people in similarly vintage buildings in the area.
Yeah, so all across Miami-Dade County, we have been undergoing emergency inspections to all older high-rise buildings. We've had about 5 buildings evacuated due to engineers finding serious structural concerns. They did say this was out of an abundance of caution. They did not think these buildings were imminently going to collapse, but given everything and given, again, that we don't know exactly what brought Champlain Towers down, they're acting out of an abundance of caution. And certainly, you know, you bring up 1980 and the people that built this building. And I think one of the important things to mention is, well, the condo association didn't move quickly and they had serious damage to their building at Champlain South. That is not a unique situation in South Florida. There are other condo associations. Some are more efficient than others. There are other buildings, lots more older than Champlain Tower South, which was actually quite young for buildings on the beach here. And so you need to look for, experts say that we need to look for a kind of perfect storm. And one of the things that might be part of that perfect storm of reasons that this happened could be in the original construction. And what the Miami Herald reported last week was that the engineer on the job at Champlain Towers had also engineered another building in a different part of Miami that was actually the Municipal Police and Fire Building. Mm-hmm. He engineered it in 1973, and the building almost immediately started showing signs of wear and tear. It had waterproofing problems. It had design problems. And one of the biggest things that came out of this was that there was actually missing rebar in some of the walls in the building. Now, for those of you that aren't familiar with job sites like me, the engineer's job as they're constructing the building is to stand there with the building plans and say, yes, the concrete guys, the contractors are putting in the rebar correctly. It's all in the right place. And so when they find that rebar is not in the right place, it does, part of the blame does fall on the engineer. And again, this is the same engineer that engineered Champlain Tower South about 5 years later. And so that is one of the red flags in the past that we're now looking at. Is it possible that a similar mistake was made at Champlain South? We just don't know yet.
Point taken, the point you made earlier is that until everybody knows how this happened, what caused it, there's sort of a resistance to making some kind of legal law changes, that sort of a thing. However, Florida state lawmakers are preparing a raft of proposals to increase regulation of the condo industry, including more frequent inspections and that sort of thing. Can you give us a thumbnail?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of talk about what to do. And the biggest thing, I think, is, at least in Miami-Dade County, is really tightening up the procedures around certain inspections that already exist. And then, as you said, maybe making them more frequent. So for large buildings of certain height or capacity, Miami-Dade County, at 40 years, they undergo this inspection by an engineer. And then every 10 years after that, that's through the county law. There is some talk about whether that needs to be a state law now. But the reason that it exists in Miami-Dade County is because oceanfront, salty air, right, lots of water, that really degrades concrete. And so that has actually been in place since the mid 70s. And it was put in place after the roof of a DEA building in Miami caved in.
Drug Enforcement Administration, you mean?
That's okay. Correct. It was an office building of the Drug Enforcement Administration and some other government agencies. It caved in. A few people died. It wasn't quite the catastrophic collapse here, but it started this 40-year process. It's what brought us that law. What we found subsequently after Champlain South is that while that law is on the books, each municipality, each building department of the 34 different cities in this county all have to apply that law on their, or that ordinance, the county code, on their own. And they have different ways of doing that. And some are better about it than others, as you can imagine. And so I think the first step here is making sure everyone is actually compliant with the rule that's on the books. And it was put on the books, again, because of a collapse, because of this collapse that we did identify a cause of. And I think you'll see more once we identify the cause of Champlain South. But in the meantime, I think what lawmakers are really thinking is, how do we take the lessons of the past, make sure we're applying them, and make sure we're actually doing what the county code says we should be.
To what extent does the dynamic of ownership in these, in so many of these condominiums play a role in this? A lot of people are on fixed income. For a lot of people, it's a second home. It's not necessarily primary, or it's primary and they have other places that they live. I mean, how well do you think people understand the issues before them as owners in these associations?
It's been my experience that most owners don't understand them at all. We're finding that out now. And in fact, some condo boards don't fully understand the process. In the case of Champlain South, there's actually an email to the city saying, please help us understand what the process is. We know we're going to come due soon. What do we have to do? So this is not a well understood procedure. And I think the other thing that you bring up, which is very interesting, is that many of these condos are owned by one person, but a renter actually lives in them.
Okay.
And a renter in Miami-Dade County does not have a legal right to any of this information. So as a renter, if you want to know what was in the inspection report, You could maybe get it from the city, but in terms of direct access, like an owner would have, you don't have that right. And that's something that people keep bringing up as a potential legal change as well. You know, if you're living in this building, you should have a right to know what's going on with it and what repairs are necessary. But that is not the case right now.
Well, Sarah Blasky, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Blasky is an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald, where she leads the team reporting on the collapse of the Champlain Tower South condo in Surfside, Florida, on June 24th. We're going to continue our conversation about what we just wrapped up with Sarah, and that is what you need to know going forward and how this can apply to any condo association across the country. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 2 weeks after the Champlain Tower South condominium collapse in Surfside, Florida, on June 24th, Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava announced the transition from search and rescue to recovery.
Nothing we can do can bring back those we've lost, but we can and we will do everything in our power possible to identify all of the victims and to offer closure to the families in this time of unimaginable grief.
And part of that closure is the public yearning for an explanation and the role of condo associations, how they operate and how they manage finances and building maintenance, maybe at the center of it. Daniel Caron manages the Cleveland law firm Caron LLC. He hosts a website and YouTube channel, yourlovablelawyer.com. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Ann.
And Jim Ambrosio is on the board of the Central Ohio chapter of the Community Associations Institute. That's an education and advocacy organization made up of homeowner and condo association board members and the professionals who serve them. He also is regional director of operations for Link Association Management, which manages property and maintenance for condominiums, homeowner associations, multifamily communities, and real estate brokerage services. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The Wall Street Journal reports that Florida's existing condo law puts much of the responsibility in the hands of association boards, that is, the groups of owners who volunteer to help manage the building. Jim Ambrosio, can you compare and contrast that with Ohio law? How does Ohio law work?
Very similarly to that, there is obviously Ohio condo law. There are chapters that specify things that condo associations must do, especially with regards to funding reserve accounts and things like that. But there's no overarching body. There's no state agency or anything like that that is auditing these types of things. So at the end of the day, on a month-to-month basis, these associations are left up to the decisions made by the volunteer boards of directors, who then rely on other industry professionals, such as their management companies, attorneys, engineers, architects, things like that, to make sure that they're following the rules and
it's
the
laws. Sort of an honor system then?
It is, yeah. Okay. Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of obviously well-intentioned laws and rules in place, but there's not a lot of oversight. So because of that, you know, you have people that are in volunteer positions that, you know, need to be subject matter experts in fields that they very commonly are not. And if they don't then rely on the expertise of people, you know, such as attorneys and engineers, who oftentimes come at you know, higher price points,
right,
that need to be budgeted for, then, you know, you can you know, lead to some issues.
I met somebody who does your kind of a job just over the weekend, just by chance, out of Colorado. And they said that when they have a client, an association client, that doesn't take their advice, that if they give them a couple chances, but if they ignore it, they don't want to pay the money, they don't want to do the job and get it done right, they'll give them up. They will leave give up the client.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not surprising. We do the same when we talk to boards of directors that are considering hiring us as their management company. I ask a lot of questions about that exact topic, because if they have not set themselves up, financially for success, as we begin to partner with them and help manage their community, it's going to make it difficult for us to succeed. And oftentimes, the boards are not the people that are known in the community. They're ultimately the ones making the decisions, but the face of the community ends up being the management company. So if things were to go wrong, we are the ones that almost take more of a PR hit than the individual board members, who can, hide a little bit more easily. So, that's really the only time that we have the ability to choose, whether or not it would be a good partnership for us and make that decision on their financial stability moving forward.
And Daniel, Karen, when somebody is thinking about buying a condominium, obviously, and by, default, getting involved in one of these associations, there's questions they should be asking. It's not just about, you want to look at the landscape and you want to make sure, things look nice, but there's more to it than that.
Well, Jim raised, I think, the best point, which is that you've got a volunteer collaboration running the show. And I'm part of an HOA where I live in Ohio. And
a homeowners association, yeah.
Yep. And we moved here from Chicago and still have a property there that's subject to, of course, a declaration and the oversight of a board. And, you would like to think that folks who know what they're doing are running the show, but often they're not. If you've ever been to a board meeting I was preparing for this morning's segment, I was watching some YouTube videos of condo board meetings. And some news reports when condo board meetings go bad, and it's a mess. I mean, it's the Wild West out there, and you got folks who don't know what they're doing, who are responsible for maintaining and overseeing the health and safety of lots of folks who are trusting them with, of course, their health and safety, and don't realize what trust they're putting in folks' hands, much less whose hands they're putting that trust in. So it's kind of a scary proposition, and despite all that, you'd think that I'd be more active in my HOA and in my board. I'm not. I too leave that oversight to folks whom I trust to do the right thing. And I get letters periodically and notices, and I read them. Sometimes they sometimes don't. And it's kind of the quintessential, if you want something done right, you might want to have to do it yourself, if that is, you're qualified to do it yourself. And if you're not, maybe you ought to engage somebody who is, perhaps a lawyer who can provide a little counsel, and counsel to the board. Because to Jim's point of a moment ago, when you've got his group not getting the respect and courtesy it would like from a board that it's consulting, the same can be said for lawyers. If, for instance, I'm consulting a board and they're not doing what I think they ought to do to maintain the health and safety of the property, for instance, what if somebody were consulting the Surfside folks? Mm-hmm. And said, hey, listen, you're waiting an awful long time for these repairs. You might want to do something, and you could have some real problems. And the board is thumbing its nose or ignoring or something in between to the lawyer. My problem is, number one, I don't like getting ignored. Number two, I don't want to get sued, because when something inevitably happens, as it did and as it will, who's the finger get pointed at first? It's always the lawyers. And there's malpractice. There are ethical concerns getting disbarred. The stigma of being associated with a property that collapsed when you were their counselor, all terrible things. So even as a lawyer, you got to be careful in terms of who you hitch your wagon to, in terms of deriving income and providing guidance.
The person that I spoke to over the weekend said to go so far, recommended that prospective condominium owners should go so far as to see the minutes of association meetings, to see how they conduct themselves and whether there are conflicts and how they're resolving the conflicts. Jim Ambrosio, what do you think?
Yeah, and I agree with that. And to the prior guest had made some commentary on that, talking about how most condo owners do not educate themselves on what they're buying into. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that's especially true with incoming condo owners. I think a lot of people just look at it as an opportunity to live somewhere in which they don't have to do certain things. I don't want to mow my grass anymore. I don't want to shovel snow, things like that. and they pay very little, if no attention to the legalities of that type of ownership and what they are financially responsible for as part of a condominium, as a unit owner in there, what the, you know, the ongoings of the association are. And that's the best way to view those is to, you know, request and review historical meeting minutes, financial reports, things like that. Those are all, you know, that's all pieces of information that should be made available to prospective unit owners. And I would say, you know, if I had to venture, I guess less than 5% of the time do we have somebody that is considering a unit in an association reach out to us and ask to see any of that. It's always after the fact, if they even request it at all.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. 2 weeks in the wake of, I should say, the Champlain Tower South condominium collapse in Surfside, Florida. We're talking about the role of condo associations, how they operate and how they manage finances and building maintenance, and how that may be or could be at the center of the problem. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Jim Ambrosio. He is a member of the board of the Central Ohio chapter of the Community Associations Institute. That's an education and advocacy organization made up of homeowner and condo association board members and the professionals who service the those communities. Also, Daniel Karen, he's a consumer rights attorney with the Cleveland law firm of Karen LLC, and he hosts a website and YouTube channel, yourlovablelawyer.com, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jim, what kind of calls and questions did you receive in the wake of the condo collapse in Surfside? I can't imagine that your phone wasn't ringing off the hook.
It was, I wouldn't say that it was ringing off the hook. I think a lot of people understood that we're a much different geographic market here than being 100 yards or so off of the Atlantic Ocean. So we do manage some high-rise and mid-rise buildings here in town. So the questions that—
And there's a lot more of them coming.
Absolutely. And so the majority, if not all of the questions that we did get were from residents who live in buildings like that. And so we very quickly, with the help of our boards of directors, we have very good boards here in the Central Ohio area at the associations we manage and partner with, you know, between the boards and us and other members of the CAI chapter, we collaborated and put information together to get out to owners to just sort of reassure them that not only is it a much different geographic market here in which we likely won't see, you know, an event like happen down there, but that, you know, your board and your industry partners are doing these types of things to assure that we are more financially stable than that particular building was. And just sort of reassure them of the plan.
You know, I know somebody who's kind of looking for a condo, Daniel Karen, and they said that when they talk to people about this or that complex, someone will say, yeah, but that's a high HOA fee. Mm-hmm. You want to stay away from that. And I kind of think, well, maybe find out what they're spending the fees on, and if there's a good, you know, set aside. If there's, you know, I mean, how are they spending it? Don't get cheap about this.
Sure. Well, before tackling that, something Jim said was pretty provocative. A minute ago. If I could just go back one quick second, mm-hmm. He talked about people really not putting a lot of time or effort into their ownership of the condo or their condo experience, figuring, hey, listen, it's pretty much like an apartment and I'll just go there.
Right.
And folks will take care of everything. And, you know, as it concerns that theme, I've always thought of condo ownership kind of like people sending their kids to private schools where, you know what, I'll pay something per month and they'll take care of everything. I'm not responsible for anything. My kid's going to turn out great. And we all know that, you know, never mind what you pay in, you still got to do the work. And you still got to do your part to ensure your own safety or your kids' education or whatever the case may be. So as it concerns HOA fees or condo fees, right, they can be a lot. And you might wonder, you know, boy, I don't know if I'm getting what I'm owed or what I deserve. Well, you know, if you don't know, take a look, because you want to make sure that your common areas are well maintained, because a condo is not like a house. I mean, if there's something wrong with your house, let's say the foundation is leaky, or you're seeing, you know, some exposed rebar. Well, you wouldn't see rebar probably in a house, but, you know, the concrete is flaking or something, mm-hmm. or the roof is bad. You're going to call the roofing guy. You're going to call the foundation guy, get an architect, get an engineer, get a water sealing person out there, and you'll fix it up. And then, you know, he'll come next Thursday, you know, make another trip, charge a little more you'd like, and you'll be done. But you can handle all that from soup to nuts because you own everything, including the exterior walls, the floor, and the ceiling. Well, in a condo, you pretty much own the airspace. And the common elements are jointly owned by everybody, including the common areas. And that would include, of course, your walls, the windows, potentially, the ceiling, the floor, and so on. So if someone's going to fix that stuff, it's not going to be you. And if someone needs to fix that stuff, there's got to be money available for the fix. And that's what goes into the assessments. And if there's a big fix due, for instance, what was on board in Sursa that they never had a chance to get to, which could cost a ton of money, that is a real problem.
Right.
I mean, you're upside down fast.
Well, they knew they were going to have to pony up eventually. And I guess it's still in question whether they were starting to raise more money for that. But you plan for that kind of thing, right, Jim Ambrosio? I mean, you see something coming. And even if you're not going to be able to deal with it right away, you're like, in 2 years, we're going to have to get to this and we got to start raising the money now.
Yeah, exactly. I go back to the saying about a tree. You know, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. But the second best time is now. And that's often the same with reserve funding with associations. You know, yes, you should have been doing this, you know, years, if not decades ago. But the next best opportunity that you have is as soon as the professionals bring this information to your attention, whether it be through a reserve study in which an engineer conducts the analysis of what you need to replace eventually and how much you'll need to fund to be able to do that. You need to be acting on that, and it needs to involve communication to residents, to owners, that is fully transparent about why the fees are going to need to be increased and that money set aside, and what the game plan is. You know, when the board is expecting to do either preventative maintenance or capital replacements of these certain items. We have found that, you know, what unit owners and associations dislike the most is fees being increased with no explanation as to why.
Uh-huh.
Because if that's the case, then it's going to lead to expectations of, well, you know, I would expect the landscaping to be better. I would expect painting to happen all the time. You know, if the things that are going to be funded are more of the, you know, unsexy types of things, such as just saving it for something 10 years down the road, or eventually, you know, replacing a roof, things that people don't really get excited about. Mm-hmm. You need to communicate that, you know, hey, you know, you're not going to see an immediate impact on these funds, but here's why. It's because, you know, we're going to need, you know, X millions of dollars 10 years from now. And this is when we're going to start to save for it.
Let's see. Barbara in German Village, you're on the air. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Anne. Thank you so much for the program. I wish I'd had it some years back when I bought into a very small condo situation, just 3 units, and I nearly lost my shirt because although I had an attorney look at the condo documents beforehand and, you know, I say that they were fine, mm-hmm. I found out some years later that when I went to sell, the association had never been set up so that there could not be a majority owner. And so owner number 2 ended up selling out to owner number 1, and I was left with a majority owner. And I can't recommend enough that people get a good condo attorney who knows what he or she is doing before they purchase to look at things like this. The condo attorney I eventually hired kept telling me that I was in by far the worst situation he'd ever seen and that he had set up many condo bylaws to prevent this from happening, but he had never seen it actually happen.
Thanks, Barbara, for bringing that up because, Daniel Karen, I mean, there's a lot of – I see a lot of condos out there that are these small operations, just 1 or 2 units. Is there a big difference in how those are managed versus legally than the big ones?
Well, that just goes to the scope of any potential problem, not really its nature. I mean, a problem deriving from a declaration that's not properly regarded is still a problem. It's just going to be smaller in scope. So maybe your fix isn't going to be a $336,000 per unit fix. It's going to be a $5,000 per unit fix. That doesn't mean that the reserve shouldn't be properly funded. And to Jim's point of a moment ago, I mean, sure, if everything's handled properly from the get-go, that's great. But what do you do when you get to today and you're hit with a special assessment because the fund isn't properly funded, or the reserve, rather, isn't properly funded, and you're all going to, you know, take it, and you don't have the money? That's something that you can and should probably plan for, too, by way of insurance coverage or or a loss assessment coverage or something to provide for the possibility that a special assessment is going to come down the pike and you might not be prepared to pay for it. I'll give you an example. This one I didn't have to really, I didn't suffer too bad from it, but I mentioned the property in Chicago a few moments ago. About a year and a half ago, I got a notice of a specialist, wasn't a special assessment, but it was the need for a big repair they were doing, and talk about, you know, unsexy repairs, like, you know, unexciting repairs, like Jim was mentioning too. It wasn't any sort of repair related to hallways or landscaping or painting. It was the internal pipes in the building. They were switching them out from rusty, clunky, gross copper pipes to PVC pipes.
Yeah.
And you can't see it, but you need it. And if it were your house, you would do it. But when it's a condo, you complain about it. And that's because they were going to bleed down the reserve by $9 million for this fix, which they had the money for because they properly planned. But when they cut holes in your walls to gain access to the pipes in three different places, those external fixes, those repairs, were on my own dime because they weren't covered. Mm-hmm. I had to handle that. And I couldn't make a claim for it either. So that was about $5,000 I needed to spend for the privilege of living in a condo that was properly funded. So I tell you, it can get you. And if you're not up for it, buy a house, but you're going to pay the same while repairing a house. You just won't complain about it because you think it's your choice, not someone else's.
We're going to take a quick break. That's Daniel Caron. He's a consumer rights attorney with the Cleveland law firm Caron LLC. And also with us, Jim Ambrosio. He's a board member of the Central Ohio chapter of the Community Associations Institute. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the fallout from the Surfside, Florida condo collapse. The disaster has raised questions about the role of condo associations, how they operate, how they manage finances and building maintenance. Still with us is Daniel Caron. He's a consumer rights attorney with the Cleveland law firm Caron LLC. Jim Ambrosio is on the board of the Central Ohio chapter of the Community Associations Institute. He's also a regional director of operations for Link Association Management, and that's one of those outfits that manages property and maintenance for condominiums, homeowner associations, multifamily communities, and real estate brokerage services. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I was talking with a reporter from the Miami Herald earlier in the program, Daniel, and she raised the salient point about that so many of the occupants of the Champlain Tower South were renters. They weren't owners, so they were completely in the dark about what was going on there. What about renters' rights in these kinds of situations, or in any kind of, you know, where there's an association involved that they're not part of?
Sure. As it turns out, I have a renter in my unit in Chicago, so that's the exact situation that I'm involved in. And I've emphasized to her that she needs to be, she needs to educate herself and to remain empowered about the condition, state of the building. Whenever I get a notice as an owner, I send it to her so that she knows what's happening. She's the boots on the ground. It's her living experience. It's my ownership experience, but she's living there. She's not a signatory to the deed or the declaration, to be sure, but that doesn't mean, as a practical matter, she shouldn't be empowered to know what the state of the building is, because after all, if God forbid it were to collapse, it's her safety, not mine, that's at issue.
And what do you think about that, Jim Ambrosio?
Yeah, I agree. I think oftentimes we find that the communication that needs to be sent to renters is more along the lines of rules and regulations, you know, what you can do with the pool and, you know, how many guests you can have and things like that. It's hardly ever about, you know, the more serious components of the building, such as what Dan was just referring to. But I agree. Just as we oftentimes don't have the owners reaching out about that, we hardly ever have renters that have any concern about that type of, you know, those types of items in the building. And I think it's usually because they're there for a year, they move out, they go mm-hmm. somewhere else, another renter comes in. They're just looking at it, you know, the same way.
Transient.
Yeah, any apartment. So oftentimes it's you know, the unit owner, you know, themselves that is responsible for making sure that they're first asking for that information and then secondly passing it along to their renters and making sure they're aware of it.
And by the way, to add on to that, as mm-hmm. it concerns internal repairs to the unit, the stove, the cabinets, those sorts of things, those aren't common areas. Those are my areas. So if she has a problem with that, she doesn't call the landlord as if she were in a pure rental property. She calls me. And I fix those on my dime. And that's the relationship I have with her as her landlord. Happens to be a condo, but she's renting from me. And I've got to be responsible and attentive to her needs.
Let's see. Arlene and Gahanna, you're on the air. Hi, Arlene.
Hi. Thank you, Ann and guests, for another very informative program. I learned that here in Franklin County that there is, and in Ohio, that there is no law that any assessments under consideration need to be disclosed to a potential buyer unless the buyer specifically asks the question, are there any assessments under consideration? We purchased a wonderful condo with a hardworking board, but when we went to our first meeting, we learned that there was going to be an assessment of over $30,000 to resize the community. And so I just wanted to share with listeners that that's a very important question to ask.
It's a buyer beware kind of a question. Jim Ambrosio, do you think is that the kind of questions people should be asking, right?
Yes, I would agree that those are the types of questions people should be asking. I think I'd probably want to defer to Dan on the legality component of that as to whether or not the association or its management company is required to disclose those types of things. Oftentimes, the reason that that is not disclosed when it hasn't been finalized yet is because you don't want to create hysteria over something that hasn't been completed. Mm-hmm. Or voted on by the board or decided and then, you know, lead to, you know, a lot of questions before the formal communications and education can be prepared. So Dan might be able to touch on that a little better.
Yeah, Daniel Karen.
That reminds me of a situation, for instance, where let's say you've got a high rise and there's an empty lot or a park or a low rise next door. And there are plans to build a high rise in place of the low rise and ruin the views from the 30th to the 50th floors. Is there a duty to disclose that? So is there a duty to disclose things that would be of consequence or meaning or purpose to the buyer? Without researching the law, of course, in Ohio and its contours, I can't know. But what I do know is that it's a perfectly suitable question for you to ask. And if they lie to you about it and they're fraudulent or they omit something that they have a duty to disclose, particularly because you ask them for the truth and they don't, you could have a claim for that.
And I would imagine if there's conversations and strategizing going on about a big improvement that would require a large any kind of assessment outside of the HOA, that would be in the minutes. And so if you I would imagine it would be in the minutes of any kind of association meeting, right, Daniel?
I can't know what they'll talk about. I would suspect it would be.
Yeah.
But I think building on that, if you're buying a condo, like again buying a house, it's really incumbent on you to learn everything you can about your home purchase, because you're purchasing a home and you're purchasing a lot more than your unit. You're purchasing your joint interest, your common interest in a lot of other areas. And to not know what effects or infects or what to expect as it concerns of other areas, and there are a lot of them, elevators, hallways, front door, security, maintenance, you're really not doing yourself justice in terms of a big purchase, because that's often the biggest purchase in folks' lives.
Jim Ambrosio, there's a lot of focus on the collapse of the building in Surfside and the relationship between the salty sea air and the concrete and the rebar. That isn't something that is of much of an issue in Central Ohio, landlocked as it is, but there are other issues because it's one of the rainiest places in the country. What do you recommend people ask questions about specifically when it comes to structural issues.
Yeah, exactly. I've had this conversation with a lot of people recently where, you know, we don't have as many of those buildings here. So while we certainly could have issues with high-rise buildings and concrete and rebar and things like that, what I've come to realize over the years as one of the more voluminous types of things that we see is with wood rot. We do have a lot of rain that we get here. We oftentimes have heavy rainstorms that'll bring a lot of rain within 20 or 30 minutes. And a lot of people don't know that prior to the mid-2000s, it was not law or it was not code to wrap buildings in what everybody refers to as Tyvek or WRB. So what we've seen very often is, you know, water, when it gets behind whatever the siding is, can then rot out that wooden OSB behind it. And, you know, we've seen so many cases of that where you take the siding off and, you know, something that would normally be a natural wood color is, you know, the color of your black monitor there. You could almost poke your finger through it. It's been so rotted out. And those are the types of things that can oftentimes go unnoticed because they're hiding. The problems are hiding behind the siding, which looks okay. And that's why I can't stress enough the importance of, you know, the engineering studies and things like that to do, you know, they call them destructive investigations where they'll take off, you know, select pieces of siding and things like that to get behind it and actually see the bones of these buildings and if there are any issues. And if there are, you know, then you start to plan for replacements and things like that appropriately. That I think is the much bigger, you know, concern in the geography.
And
we
this
have
is
here.
Something the association should be engaging somebody to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Because, you know, it should be just part of the routine, you know, preventative maintenance of the association. There are I've mentioned before the concept of the reserve study. A reserve study is what an association should have done at a certain point or when it gets to a certain age, and then it gets updated every, you know, 3 to 5 years. And that's where a third-party professional engineering firm is coming in, and they're doing these inspections of these types of things. These are things that the homeowners, the board members, and even the property management representatives are oftentimes not, you know, educated enough on to be able to know, you know, what they should be properly inspecting. These people are, though, and they can come in and they can look at these things, put these reports together, and then help kind of guide the board for funding the replacements of those things.
And that's precisely the point, because contrast that, if I may, with purchasing a standalone home, where you go in and you bring an inspector and he or she takes a look at everything, the foundation, the roof, the basement, whatever. If there's a problem, you talk about it because it's manageable. You can do that because you're talking to the person who owns the home and who's who has the control over all aspects of its maintenance. Mm-hmm. You contrast that with a condo, and you've got a board that's supposed to do this. And if they do it, you've got to get your hands on the report. And if they don't do it, there's nothing to even look at. So you're a little bit hamstrung from the get-go as it concerns, ascertaining the safety and vitality and structural integrity, that's the word, of the building. And that can be a little scary, especially if it's an older building, like Jim said.
Right. And Daniel, just real quick, because we're running out of time, but when you say supposed to be doing this, mm-hmm. are you talking about a legal obligation or a tradition of I'm on a board and we're managing this building and we're supposed to do this, but we don't have to do it?
You're obligated legally to do it, whether by statute, by the Condo Act, or by terms set out in your declaration. Look what happened in Surfside. They were supposed to have done this. They kind of kicked the ball around a little bit and didn't quite do it. And then it was too late. But like Jim said, whether it's a term of years, 3 years, or however many, whether by declaration or statute, you're supposed to prepare a reserve study to ensure the safety and integrity of the building. That's what we're talking about. And that's what ought to give you peace of mind as an owner, if that is you have a responsible board that's done its job.
Well, Daniel, Karen, thanks so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Daniel Karen is a consumer rights attorney with the Cleveland law firm Karen LLC, and he hosts a website and YouTube channel, yourlovablelawyer.com. And Jim Ambrosio, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me on.
Jim Ambrosio is a board member of the Central Ohio Chapter of the Community Associations Institute. That's an education and advocacy organization made up of homeowner and condo association board members and the professionals who serve them. And he's also a regional director of operations for Link Association Management. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.